This is the second day of this November 2007 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from yesterday, a book called The Essential Teachings of Zen Master Hakuin, translated by Norman Waddell. I will go to a new chapter in this today. The translation of the title of the chapter is The Poisonous Leavings of Past Masters. You have to understand when Hakuin speaks of poison and evil, usually, depending on the context, but very often, he's paying tribute to these masters or the teachings. It's poison in the sense of killing our ego attachments. There are several paragraphs here that I think are not going to work in reading in Taisho. So we'll just pick up on several pages into the chapter. At present, this country is infested with a race of smooth-tongued, worldly-wise Zen teachers who feed their students a ration of utter nonsense. I think of our present time, where you're seeing a growing kind of commercialization of Zen, and even among Zen teachers. There's one where a teacher has copyrighted the term big mind. There's no reason to think that this won't continue. And the slick promotions that you see in articles in Buddhist magazines, Tricycle and Buddha Dharma, we've talked about whether we should have a larger ad in these magazines. We've experimented with smaller kind of notices about the existence of the center. But I feel, and others here feel, that we don't particularly want to copy others in this kind of relentless self-promotion. The country is infested with a race of smooth-tongued, worldly-wise Zen teachers who feed their students a ration of utter nonsense. And then he speaks in place of these teachers who he is denouncing. Why do you suppose Buddha patriarchs through the ages were so mortally afraid of words and letters, they ask you? It is, they answer you, because words and letters are a coast of jagged cliffs constantly lashed by a vast ocean of poison, ready to swallow up your wisdom, drown the very life from it. Giving students stories and episodes from the Zen past, he's referring to koans, and having them try to penetrate their meaning is a practice that did not start until after the school had branched out into the five houses and seven schools. It was an expedient teaching method, employed provisionally. It doesn't represent the ultimate reaches of the Buddha patriarchs. Now, having that statement come from one who had drunk deeply of the great heritage of koan wisdom would be one thing, but he's presenting this as those who have never worked on them, who are afraid to work on them, and then who try to dismiss them in this way. Hakuin continues, an incorrigible pack of skin-headed mules has ridden teachings like these to a position of dominance in the world of Zen. Unable to distinguish master from servant, jades from common stones, they gather together and sit. Rows of sleepy, inanimate lumps. They hug themselves, self-satisfied, imagining they are paragons of the Zen tradition, belittling the Buddha patriarchs of the past and treating their fellow priests with contempt. While true celestial phoenixes linger starving in the shadows, a hateful flock of owls and ravens, comfortable and full-bellied, rule the roost. But without the eye of Kensho, they won't be able to use a single drop of the knowledge they gain. When they die, they will fall straight into hell. So I say to them, if upon becoming a Buddhist monk you do not penetrate the Buddha's truth, turn in your black robe. Give back all the donations you've received. Be a layman again. He continues, don't you realize that every syllable contained in the Buddhist canon, all 5,048 scrolls of it, is a rocky cliff that juts out into deadly poison-filled seas? Don't you know that each of the 28 Buddhas and 6 Buddhist saints is a body of virulent poison that rises in monstrous waves, blackening the skies, swallowing the radiance of the sun and moon, extinguishing the light of the stars and planets? It is there, as clear and stark as it could be. It stares you right in the face. But none of you is awake to see it. You are like an owl venturing into the light of day, gazing around with eyes wide open, but unable to see a mountain towering in front of it. It isn't because the mountain bears a grudge against owls and wants to avoid them. The responsibility lies with the owl alone. This statement, it is there, as clear and stark as it could be. It stares you right in the face. What is this it that he's telling us about? Well, we know, don't we? It's this matter of birth and death. It's this matter of our enlightened nature. It's enlightened nature that we don't yet know, certainly not fully. It's this opportunity that is as clear and stark as it could be. It's this opportunity that stares us in the face. Part of us knows that this is it. This is, if there is any purpose at all we can speak of to human life, it is to awaken to our true nature, to understand the nature of reality. And to whatever extent we have failed to do that, to seize this opportunity, to fulfill this mandate of a human existence, and it will remain there, staring us in the face, stark. He goes on, you might cover your ears with your hands, or cover your eyes with a blindfold, or try some other means to avoid the poisonous fumes. But you can't escape the clouds that sail in the sky, the streams that tumble down the hillsides. You can't escape the falling autumn leaves and scattering spring flowers. And then moving down the page here, again, he lays into those who deny this task before us. He says, the teaching Zen priests today are busily imparting to their students sounds something like this. Don't misdirect your effort by chasing around looking for something outside yourself. All you have to do is to concentrate on being thoughtless and doing nothing whatever. No practice, no realization. Doing nothing, the state of no mind, is the direct path to sudden realization. No practice, no realization is the true principle, things as they really are. The enlightened Buddhas of the Ten Directions have called this supreme, unparalleled, right awakening. Now, the problem here is that, again, for one who has realized her true nature, these things can be said. That from the very, very beginning, there's never been anything but this enlightened nature. And so long as we are grasping at a goal, then we will just obstruct ourselves. In fact, you can see this in the texts of the Chinese masters. Often you'll hear this injunction, just don't strive. This is where words can be confusing. But what those great Chinese predecessors of Hakuin were saying was, don't set up a goal in your mind and grasp at it as something out there. This doesn't work. It doesn't work to hold the thought of Kensho in your mind. This is the ultimate obstruction. Hakuin is not saying that. He's not saying to hold the thought of Kensho in your mind. He's saying apply yourself. Now, while you are in decent physical condition, health, and can do it, apply yourself to your practice. And don't complacently sit back and say, Tangen Roshi actually weighed in on this. When I was in Bukokuji in Japan, he was doing the same. He was harpooning these Buji Zen adherents. In the same way, Buji Zen is the position that, okay, we're all enlightened from the very beginning, so there's nothing we need to do. And he put his hands down in the Zazen Mudra and made kind of a smug face and said, me, Buddha. Hakuin continues, people hear this teaching and try to follow it, choking off their aspirations, sweeping their minds clean of delusive thoughts. They dedicate themselves to doing nothing but keeping their minds complete blanks, blissfully unaware that they are, in the process, doing and thinking a great deal. So here Hakuin is reminding us that conceptual stance that these Buji Zen adherents are taking, they're clinging to a notion of enlightenment, a notion of utter perfect enlightenment from the very beginning. Skipping a few more paragraphs here. He quotes another master, Zen master Nantong Yuan Ching said, you must see your own nature as clearly and unmistakably as you see the palm of your hand. At the fundamental ground of your being, there must be an undisturbed tranquility. And then Hakuin himself comments on this. I want to impress all patricians who probe the secret depths, great men all, with the need to put your innate power to work for you as vigorously and relentlessly as you can. The moment your Kensho is perfectly clear, throw it aside and dedicate yourself to boring through the difficult-to-pass koans. Now, these are the Nanto koans. Once you are beyond those barriers, you will understand exactly what the Buddha meant when he said that a Buddha can see the Buddha nature with his own eyes as distinctly as you see a fruit lying in the palm of your hand. This word patricians that he uses is probably referring to an old convention in the sutras you hear the Buddha himself referring to his monks as you of good family, in the sense that once one has committed one's life to the Buddha Dharma, then one is joined this family. You're in the Buddha's family, the Buddha's own family, and it's often called the Arya Sangha. Arya means noble, the Arya Sangha of monks. I think that's what he means by you patricians, all patricians who probe the secret depths. He goes on, once you penetrate to see the ultimate meaning of the patriarchal teachers, you will be armed for the first time with the fangs and claws of the Dharma cave. You will sport the divine life-usurping talisman. You will enter into the realm of the Buddhas, stroll leisurely through the realms where evil demons dwell, pulling out nails, wrenching free wedges, dispersing great clouds of compassion as you go, practicing the great Dharma giving, and rendering immense benefit to the monks who come to you from the four quarters. Let's go back over this. So once you've seen into self nature deeply, you'll be armed with the fangs and claws of the Dharma cave. The enlightened mind that can be used, not just to have it, but to know it and therefore be able to employ it, helping others. You'll be able to stroll leisurely through the realms where evil demons dwell. We can. Understand this as being invulnerable to the obstructive mind states that can plague one in different stages of practice, makyo, to have seen into one's nature is to have seen through forms. The world of form. And then, yes, one may still have makyo after that. One may even be harassed by old karmic afflictions. But they will not be menacing in the same way because one has seen through the world of form. They're there, but they're not there. One understands that. Pulling out nails, wrenching free wedges. These are, this means seeing through the afflictions of the mind, the stubborn afflictions that are so ingrained in us. Practicing the great Dharma giving. What is the great Dharma giving? It is giving one's mind to whatever is before one. And during Zazen, it's giving oneself completely to one's practice. This is the ultimate act of dana, D-A-N-A, giving, generosity. You could say that Zazen in its purest is pure giving, which really means giving up one's clinging to thoughts, giving one's attention, giving one's whole mind to this breath or this koan. Rendering immense benefit to the monks who come to you. And then he says, but you will still be the same old monk you always were. You won't be doing anything out of the ordinary. Your eyes will stare out from your face from the same location as before. Your nose will be where it always was. Yet now you will be the genuine article, an authentic descendant of the Buddhas and patriarchs, to whom you will have fully repaid that incalculable debt of gratitude which you owe them. What is this debt of gratitude that we owe Buddhas and patriarchs? It is for their help in preserving the Dharma, that we might then find this path to liberation. How many people in this world have found the way beyond all attachments, including attachment to the notion of God. This simple practice, this simple, simple practice that unties all fetters sooner or later. He goes on, you will be at liberty to spend your days free from the clutches of circumstance. Free from the clutches of circumstance. Surely there are many people here who can appreciate the spirit of that phrase, being caught in the clutches of circumstance, being pitched about in our daily lives from one stress to another, never enough time, racing to keep up, meet the deadlines. The squeeze between the demands of family life and those of work, putting aside the things that one might want to do, one has always longed to do because of these time pressures and all these competing demands. We don't have to be bound by these things when we fully join with them, become one with them. Then they no longer bind us. And we are no longer in the clutches of circumstance. And we are no longer caught by change. You will drink tea when it is given, eat rice when it is served. Doing and non-doing will be firmly in your grasp. Not even the Buddha patriarchs will be able to touch you. You'll be a true monk, worth alms of millions in gold. Notice here, now he is acknowledging the wisdom of this non-doing, where he says, doing and non-doing will be firmly in your grasp. That is, they will fuse, where we don't fragment our lives into what when we're doing things, when we're active, and when we're inactive or resting or enjoying ourselves. If, on the other hand, you follow the trend of the times, when you enter the dark cave of unknowing in the eighth consciousness, you will start bragging about what you have achieved. You will go around telling everyone how enlightened you are. You will accept, under false pretenses, the veneration and charity of others, and wind up being one of those arrogant creatures who declares he has attained realization when he has not. When you enter the dark cave of unknowing in the eighth consciousness, as a footnote here. I'll just read this. The eighth consciousness, the Alaya consciousness, is regarded as the source of human consciousness and all existence. When practitioners penetrate to it, they are considered to have finally succeeded in overcoming evil passions. But if they cling to it, it becomes another cause trapping them within birth and death. The next chapter is called Authentic Zen. Now here Hakuin launches into his most extravagantly creative imagination. What he's doing here is offering a narrative of the transmission of the Dharma. I'll let him speak for himself. He says, when a son of the Shakya clan went into the fastness of the snowy mountains long ago to begin his first retreat, of course he's talking about the Buddha, Shakyamuni, he cradled secretly in his arms an ancient stringless lute. And this is a simile, a metaphor that he'll carry through now, on and on. He strummed it with blind devotion for over 6 years. That would be the 6 years of his ascetic practice, until one morning he saw a beam of light shining down from a bad star and was startled out of his senses. Right, that's the enlightenment. There's that bad, that word bad again, bad star. It's just so Zen-like to refrain from these sugary, so-called spiritual language that you find in other traditions, because these things themselves can become an attachment, this way of speaking and thinking. Hakuin and other masters would have none of this. They'd just be quick to bring it down to the most bare and the lute, strings and all, shattered into a million pieces. Presently, strange sounds began to issue from the surrounding heavens. Marvelous tones rose from the bowels of the earth. From that moment, he found that whenever he so much as moved a finger, sounds came forth that wrought successions of wondrous events, enlightening living beings of every kind. It began in the Deer Park, where he strummed an old four-strutted instrument from which issued 12 elegant tones. The four-strutted instrument, of course, is his first discourse, the Four Noble Truths. The 12 elegant tones are the 12-fold chain of dependent co-origination. In mid-career at Vulture Peak, he articulated the perfectly rounded notes of the one vehicle. At the end, he entered the Grove of Cranes, and from there, the sad strains of his final song were heard. This must be his parinirvana. Yeah, the final song we see here in a footnote. Was called the Sutra of the Bequeathed Teaching, which was supposed to have been his last discourse before entering Nirvana. His repertoire reached a total of 5,040 scrolls of marvelously wrought music. A person appeared who understood. He could grasp those notes at the touch of a single string. He was known as Great Turtle. This is, of course, his successor, Mahakashapa, who smiled when the Buddha held up the flower. He could grasp these notes at the touch of a single string. When his carapace fractured, a sudden blossom burst of cracks and fissures, the melody was taken up on the strings of 28 mighty instruments. These are the first 28 patriarchs in the Indian line. The last of them was a divine, blue-eyed virtuoso with a purple beard. Enter Bodhidharma. How wonderful he was! With one sweep of the lion strings, he swallowed up the voices of all the six schools. Eight times the phoenix strings sang out. Eight times the divine lute passed in secret transmission. The source of it all was this man from the land of Koshi in South India, who was born the son of a king. When he reached the forested peaks of the Bear's Ears, he amused himself playing on a holeless iron flute. The sounds were magnificent, but he found they were unable to rend people to their deepest souls. So he parceled out his own skin, flesh, bone, and marrow instead. There's a famous story of Bodhidharma calling on his four chief disciples to present their understanding. And in succession, he said to each one, to the first one, you have my skin, to the second, you have my flesh, the third, my bone, and finally to Weku, his successor, he said, you have my marrow, the marrow of my teaching. Seven steps after him, the transmission stumbled, and a blind, lifeless old nag was loosed upon the world. This refers to the great Ma Zu, whose family name meant horse or something. It's some kind of a pun with horse. Oh yeah, that the Indian patriarch Prajnatara had predicted that Matsu's teacher would produce a spirited young horse who would trample the world into dust. So this lifeless old nag was loosed upon the world. More irony from Hakuin. He reared up on his hind legs, pawing the air in high spirits. With his 360 joints lathered up, throwing deadly milk wildly in all directions, and showers of blood and sweat streaming violently up through his 84,000 pores, he stomped the trilocosm universe into dust. He smashed the vaults of heaven into atoms with deafening neighs, striking such panic into millions of Mount Sumerus, they toppled over each other trying to escape, and he ravaged every land in the six directions, leaving them strewn behind in tiny pieces. Nowhere is there language like this. Nowhere does the unbounded spirit of enlightenment as it's conveyed so vividly as in Hakuin's language. We'll go on. These sounds carried to the foot of Mount Nanshuan, where a divine celestial drum took up the beat of its own accord. Changsha and Zhao Zhou fell into harmony with the mysterious direct pointing and broke into powerful personal renditions of the secret melody. It reached an old ferryman at the Thai ford who liked to pass the time tapping away on the sides of his boat. He rapped out rough, barbaric tunes that drowned out the notes of more graceful singers. This is an allusion to Ganto, who were told, taught people while working as a ferryman at the Thai ford after he had been forced to return to lay life during a government suppression of Buddhism. He goes on, the sternest, most trenchant notes that came from the holeless flute reached the abbot's chambers at the Kwang Tai Yuan in Kwangnan province, where a poisoned drum was slung upside down. From that drum emerged sounds that drained men's souls and burst men's livers, littering the landscape with the bodies of over 80 men and striking who knows how many others deaf and mute. These 80 men seems to refer to the Dharma heirs of Yunmen, Umon. And the countless, when he talks about the countless others, these are just those who trained under Yunmen, who without receiving his formal sanctioning, he said Yunmen was supposed to have had over 1,000 students. And then he mentions another master, Xiao Tsung, restrung the lute and carried it up into the fastnesses of Mount Tung. Chung Shen clasped it to his bosom and entered Mount Shui Do. That's referring to Secho, one of the co-authors of the Blue Cliff record. From these pinnacles emanated sounds that shook the whole world. Roarings of an iron lion were heard over the lands west of the river. They would have killed the spirit in a wooden man. Bayings of a straw dog filled the skies over Lake Tzu. They would have started hard sweat on the flanks of a clay ox. Another true man emerged. He was the son of the Tung family of Pa Shi in Ming Chao. This is Wu Zhu Fayen. His Japanese name is Goso. Known as the Old Man of the Eastern Mountain, he devoted himself as a young monk to austere religious discipline at Broken Head Peak. Later, he concealed his presence inside a clump of white cloud. One morning, he entered a rice hulling shed, tucked up his hemp robe, and made a single circumambulation of the millstone. The thunder from this voiceless cloth drum rolled angrily out, snarling and snapping, and filled the world with far-reaching reverberations. You would have thought the thunder god himself had been hired to pound a poison drum. It rendered three Buddhas utterly senseless, and it drained all the courage from a quiet man. These three Buddhas were the three Dharma heirs of Gosho. And the quiet man is another guy I haven't heard of, whose name contains the character for quiet in it. Da Wei chanted. His voice reached up and down the coasts of Hengyang. Da Wei, many of you will recognize that name as from Swampland Flowers, a book of his teachings. Da Wei was the Chinese master who is said to have restored the vigor of the koan system. Wu Chun roared. The reports pierced the bottom of the dragon pool. Long howls emanating from Hu Chi, Tiger Hill, shook whole forests to their roots. Bitter, soul-rending cries from a yellow dragon checked sailing clouds in their tracks. These are more masters than I'm not familiar with, so I'm guessing that no one else here would be. An old farmer in Su Ming, who called himself Shi Kong, resting farmer, kept up a constant stream of song as he swung his iron mattock. One day he saw an ancient column of light emanate from a large peak and illuminate a memorial tower. The marvelous principle entered his fingertips, inspiring them to move across the strings. So, of course, these instruments, the string, the lute, the iron, the holeless iron flute, this is the teaching, the Dharma. This old farmer who kept up a constant stream of song as he swung his iron mattock. How do you do that? How do you proclaim the Dharma as you're out working in the field, mowing the lawn, shoveling snow? You just mow the lawn. You just shovel the snow. Nothing left over. Absolute single-minded engagement with it. There's the Dharma. There's the ancient song. How do you do it when you're eating soup? You know how. You know how. You just eat the soup. For one who is working on a koan, that means you do that just through the koan. The sounds produced shook two forests to their roots and swept through 10 temples. All right, this will go on too much longer for us to try to finish it, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.